accession number 18772, reel 5.
Don Thompson, reel 5.
One incident that always remains very firmly fixed in my mind, I think it'll be with me forever more, was we had a chap in A Company by the name of Phillips, Sergeant Phillips. Now, Titch had been with the Sherwood Foresters all through World War II. I believe he had been a member of the forerunner to the Special Air Service, and he was a very, very experienced NCO. In the SANS mess in Hong Kong, he was always the target of RSM's virile tongue, in as much that I suppose Titch really was a little bit of a rebel, wouldn't always abide by mess etiquette. Anyway, Sergeant Phillips led one of the assaults off 217 at the height of the battle, in order to try and get down the forward slope to determine the strength of the enemy. And he and other members of his platoon, as I recall, crossed the floor of the valley, began to make their way up the forward slope of 317, when a mortar burst caught them and Titch Phillips' body was flung upon the barbed wire entanglement which surrounded the bottom of the hill. And for the whole of the remainder of the battle there, Titch's body lay on the wire, and we could never get to him. And as a result of his action, Sergeant Phillips was awarded the posthumous MM. And of course, when we got back into the reserve positions, obviously, you know, the topic of conversation was how Titch died. And the fact that the Chinese forces would not allow us to go forward and recover his body from the wire. Two other members of the patrol who were with Sergeant Phillips at the time, they were killed in the mortar bomb burst, and you know, we couldn't recover their bodies either. So into reserve we went, recouped, had our first hot meal for heaven knows how long, had our first sleep. We all met together, the whole battalion came together, and then we stayed there for about 2 or 3 weeks. And then we went back into the line, where basically we were in defensive positions and confined to reconnaissance and fighting patrols. It was in those positions that I perhaps saw for the very first time the effects of a napalm attack. Our forward companies were on an escarpment, again overlooking a valley, on the other side of which was a ridge, which I think had the title of London Ridge, simply because the Chinese forces had the audacity to walk along the top of this ridge in broad daylight, sort of taunting us, saying, "Here we are, you know, shoot us if you want to," sort of thing. At that time, if I recall rightly, the 8th Irish Hussars, the tank regiment, had been replaced by the 5th Royal Inniskilling Dragoon Guards. And the commanding officer of the 5th Inniskillings was anxious to show his force in strength. So I believe that an attack was planned which would take the 5th Inniskillings across the valley and attempt to capture London Ridge. Fighting patrols had established that the Chinese were dug in quite great strength on the top of London Ridge. So before the armour attack was due to take place, an airstrike was ordered using cannon and napalm. We stood to during the napalm attack, which started at about 6:30 in the morning. And I remember this flight of US Marine Corsairs coming across, circling the area and then climbing sharply and then coming down one at a time and releasing their napalm bombs on the forward slopes and across the top of London Ridge. And it was absolutely terrifying. We were about, what, half to three quarters of a mile away from, but when the napalm actually hit the ground and burst, you could hear the tremendous roar, and psychologically we could feel the heat released by this napalm. And the whole of the ridge was left a burning mess. And would you believe it? When the armor attack finally went in, the tanks were subject to anti-tank fire from the top of the ridge. Now, how on earth the Chinese forces had survived the napalm attack, we shall never, ever know. It was suggested that the whole of London Ridge was riddled with deep tunnels, which they climbed into and sort of pulled the shutters down behind them, so the napalm went over the top. But it's absolutely incredible. And in order to ensure that the chieftain tanks from the 5th Dragoon Guards got back safely, a divisional artillery shoot was ordered on the top of the ridge. If I've got the name wrong, then it's my memory's fading. But after the shoot was called London Ridge. But that really taught us, you know, that napalm is a dreadful weapon. And on this occasion, it didn't particularly achieve its objective. I wouldn't doubt, you know, that perhaps used in less secure and heavily fortified positions, that he would be extremely lethal. But he certainly didn't do a lot that day. Another thing that came across to me quite strongly as well in the final positions that we occupied before we actually came out of Korea, again, US Marine Corsairs were carrying out an airstrike, this time with cannon machine gun fire on a position, and one of the aircraft was hit. And it went out of sight behind the feature that they were attacking. And the remainder of the flight gained height, and they circled the position for about 10 to 15 minutes. And then we heard the noise of the helicopter coming across. And this US helicopter came across, went down behind the ridge. And as the helicopter went down, so these Corsairs, one at a time, also came down. And we couldn't see what they were firing at, but we heard the clatter of machine gun fire. And then after about 5 minutes or so, we saw the helicopter rise again from the other side of the ridge and then take off, escorted by the Marine aircraft. So they must have gone in and rescued the pilot. I was always full of admiration as well, you know, for the splendid work that those medevac helicopters did at the US Air Force. They are evacuating casualties from the forward areas. Those pilots, though, they did extremely heroic work. They were landing on sites, you know, that you wouldn't walk upon, let alone land a helicopter on. Because on the initial battles for 217 and Mariang Sinai casualties were horrendous, and there's a whole list in those documents there, you know, showing how many we suffered. So the our own regimental aid post and that of who was joining us, Norfolk, of course. They were suffering their own casualties because they were counterattacking the features in support of our counterattack on 217. They were attacking the features to our left, and they were suffering casualties as well. But our regimental aid post was so overwhelmed, you know, that we happened to take a casualty across to the Norfolks. So getting the bulk of the wounded evacuated as quickly as possible was a mammoth task, and the helicopters were sort of queuing up to come into land, you know, to take them on board. Because they could only carry two actual stretchy wounded at a time. They could take two walking wounded in the cabin, but they did an absolutely tremendous job, you know. And I feel certain that there must be many of our wounded who owe their lives to the U.S. pilots. And then of course they were evacuated then to the Norwegian Mobile Army Surgical Hospital, the Norwegian MASH, which was about 10 miles behind the line. they did a tremendous job. The doctors and nurses there, they worked wonders. So the rest of our time in Korea was spent basically in defensive positions. And one of our senior warrant officers, Marsden, Tom Marsden, who was the company sergeant major of the support company, told us on our last quarterly regimental meeting that the Royal Leicestershire Regiment was credited with the last offensive action of the whole of the Korean War. So when we actually moved forward onto 217 and then moved down the slope on the other side to attempt to take 317, Maryongsan, and we had to withdraw because of the intense fire, that apparently was the last offensive move of the Korean War. Because thereafter, if Tom has got his facts right, all other actions were defensive. And then, of course, the came the time when handover took place. We were occupying some positions just south of the Imjin River, again in defensive positions. And the chap who was taken over from me, believe it or not, a chap named Bluey from the 1st Royal Australian Regiment. And they were our reliefs. I handed over our forward positions to Bluey, who had been in the 8th Army in the desert. Of course, all the 1st Royal Australian Regiment were all Section A reservists. So Bluey had seen action. Nonetheless, it was quite surprising, and it makes you realise how battle-hardened you become. Whilst we were up there, there was some sporadic artillery fire coming across on the other side, and when he heard the gun fire on this particular occasion, though, he and heard the shell come over, he ducked, and I didn't. And he said, "Sorry about that, sport." He said, "I'm a bit out of practice." He says, "A long time since anybody shot at me like that." But on reflection, I thought, "Well, that's funny. He ducked, and I didn't." You know, you become rather blasé. So then, we came out of the line after handing over. It took us about 4 days to hand over the position, you know, because we handed over all our signal equipment, or the telephones line that were laid. And then we came back again into a divisional reserve position, and then down to Britannia Camp, back onto the train, which by this time had all these horrible old wooden bunks taken out, and they got, you know, sort of Pullman type seating, just like a train back home here, you know. And then we eventually got down to Pusan. Oh, we spent a couple of nights at Britannia Camp, which by that time had been completely refurbished, got a nappy, you know, and actual bunk beds, far different to when we went up, when we slept on the floor. And then the saddest occasion of all regiments which were leaving Korea went through this, the memorial service at the military cemetery at Pusan. The plateau overlooking the cemetery had been sort of levelled off, and you know, bit of hardcore put down. Flagpoles, United Nations flag, the Korean flag, and the flags of the regiments who were going home. But to actually stand there on that plateau, you know, and listen to the bugler playing last post, to see all those, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of white crosses, it made you realise, you know, that a lot of people had died in the Korean War. It's very often referred to as the Forgotten War, you know, but those members of the association who've gone back, you know, year after year and gone back to Pusan, you know, they say the memory of that farewell parade overlooking the cemetery, you know, is still with them. Because it makes you realise, you know, how many actually lost their lives. And those are only people who were accounted for. We have at least 11 members of our battalion who never been found. Missing, presumed, killed. You know.
What did you see of the situation of Korean civilians?
Very, very few. On odd occasions, Jim Terry, myself, my counterpart, who the other platoon sergeant, we very occasionally had to go through Seoul to the US Army base supply depot in order to pick up supplies. They used to carry the stocks, you see, for all the United Nations forces. So, for example, obviously, in the infantry, we used the 88 wireless set between platoons, and then the 31 sets, and then the 61, that's right. 88, 31s, 61 sets. 19s were operated by raw signals back to a brigade. You'd have to go to the supply depot in order to pick up supplies. And we would occasionally drive through the outskirts of Seoul. Now, looking at Seoul now and remembering Seoul as it was, it's just like another world. I think the Koreans, in their usual passive indifference, accepted the situation as it was. But of course, Seoul changed hands about five times. North Koreans occupied in the first push, then the United Nations pushed them back. Chinese came back, pushed back. Chinese came back, pushed back, you see. And I think the residents of Seoul in particular, you know, had sort of become resigned to the fate. The smaller towns, Weijeongbu, for example, that was a small industrial town that had been completely and utterly devastated. There was nothing left, no civilians there at all. There wasn't even a cat or a dog to be seen. You know, the whole town had been completely destroyed. And what the engineers had done, they'd cleared all the rubble off the road, you see, so that we had a passage through. But we used to have to go through Weijeongbu in order to get through the outskirts of Seoul to the US supply depot. There were very, very few civilians as such in the battle area itself, but when the fighting sort of settled down a little bit, one or two of the farmers and peasants did start to come back. But our biggest contact with the locals, of course, was the Korean porters. Each unit, each regiment had its own quota of porters. They were very, very, very conscientious. We had a young university student attached to the signal platoon who sort of acted as an interpreter. We used to call him Chico, you know, but I forget his real name now. But he was very, very, very intelligent. He spoke good English. And we used to try to get him into conversation, you know, how do Koreans feel about United Nations forces? And it was though somebody had inserted a tape recorder into his brain, you know, because all he would say is, the Korean people are very grateful for the efforts that are being put into saving our country, you know. And so, and this was the whole theme, that they would never elaborate on it. How do you feel about the devastation, we are grateful to you know, the United Nations. And they would never sort of tell us what they really, really felt. Chico's parents and family actually lived in Seoul, and I don't know how they'd been affected, you know, by the fighting that went on in the capital, but they would never expand upon it. All they wanted to do was to serve the units that they were with. Most conscientious, but very passive. They would never reveal their true thoughts to us. Apart from that, as I say, there were no civilians actually to have contact with.
How do you feel? Did you have any long term effects from having served in Korea?
I don't think so. No, I reflect upon this now when I hear about, you know, the Gulf War syndrome and the Falklands. I think possibly the training methods were far different. I always say to my wife, you know, if we're going on a journey anywhere, because I always quote one of Sergeant McLaughlin's favourite sayings, you know, in Young Soldier Battalion. Don't forget, my laddies, time spent in reconnaissance is seldom wasted. In other words, always plan what you're going to do before you do it. And then, you know, things shouldn't go wrong. So if I go on a stage journey, I'll go to very, very the great lengths to plan the route first, because I always remember what Sergeant Mack says, and it is a saying that Joyce and I have between us, you know, remember what Sergeant Mack said, time spent in reconnaissance is seldom wasted. And I think possibly it was the inbuilt discipline which we accepted as part and parcel of what we had undertook. Because when I swore allegiance to king and country in the recruiting office the day I went down to enlist, you know, that always stuck in my mind. That is what I was meant to do. That seems to suggest that the modern soldier is not prepared for what he needs to face up to. I'm not suggesting that at all. All that I'm saying is that I don't know of anyone who I serve with in Korea who suffers in any way whatsoever. Obviously, bad health in many ways is taken over now because we're all moving up into our 70s. Because the youngest of us would be 69, allowing for the fact, you know, that you couldn't go into a theatre of war under the age of 19. So any man who went to Korea with us in 1951, the age of 19 has got to be at least, 68, 69. So obviously the old age ailments are taking over from us. Psychologically, no, I don't know of anyone who suffered psychologically. Don't ask me why, I can't answer that. I talked to, on regimental reunion weekends, I talked to members of the signal platoon who were with us. Because, you see, the problem with the signal platoon was that mortar bombs and artillery shells have no respect for telephone lines. And what we used to do between the signal office at the command post and the forward companies, we would lay two lines by alternate routes so that each forward company had two telephone lines, so that if one line went out, you still got the second one. The problem was, of course, that under a sustained mortar or artillery attack, if both lines went out, then one of the line parties had to go out and lay at least one further line. Now, that meant that if the forward companies were under attack and the lads up there had got their heads down, right, my lads, signalers, were out laying lines, and that is why we suffered more than our fair share of casualties, because we were out, you see, when we just used to hope and pray, you know, that the Chinese gunners wouldn't mess up our lines. Another occasion, of course, when we would have to go out is if for some reason the wireless sets failed. Now, that should only happen through physical conditions, because we always made certain, you see, that they had at least one replacement set, and that each set, both in use and replacement, had at least one spare battery. Now, of course, sometimes the signallers would perhaps have to get out of the slit trench in a hurry, you see, and the set would become damaged. And then if the replacement set also got damaged, then we had to get another set up to them, because communication is of vital importance.
What do you feel about the worthwhileness or otherwise of the war itself?
As was not to reason why, we were fulfilling the Charter of the United Nations, and we saw it as our duty as soldiers of the United Nations, you know, to do what we had to do.
So it was a professional attitude, purely and simply?
Yes, it had to be. If you began to query what you were doing, then you could start to be in deep trouble. For instance, I don't know whether this is a well-known fact, and perhaps it might be an idea if the tape is switched off. I'll put it back on if you wish. Yeah. One very sad aspect of the Korean War, in response to perhaps a point that Conrad made about loyalty, because the battalion was so depleted, remember that we had sent quite a large number of personnel up to Korea in the first instance with the Argylls and the Middlesex. We were very, very seriously under strength. And what was arranged by War Office was that reinforcements for the battalion would come out on the troop ship that was to take the battalion up to Pusan. And this would include a large number of reinforcements intended for the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers. They were to be taken over by us, and we were to take on board also members of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers who were already in Korea but hadn't served their time. Now, of this number that we met up with in Britannia Camp, there was a hardcore of, I think it's about 29 in number, who felt that through regimental loyalty that they could not see their way clear to go into action wearing another regiment's cap badge. So they refused to go into action. And very, very sadly, these lads were court-martialed and found guilty. Possibly through displaced loyalty. As a court orderly at their court-martial, I think I can sympathise with their point of view in as much that they felt loyalty to their regiment. And I've often wondered how I would have felt if I had been asked to wear a cap badge of a regiment outside my own particular corps of regiments, which was the Leicester's, Middlesex, Leicester's, Warwick's, Lincoln's and Forester's. So I can sympathise with them to a degree, but it really did bring into question the loyalty of the professional soldier. However,
you're also going to tell me about living conditions.
Living conditions, yes. When we move from divisional reserve into brigade reserve, before the Battle of Mariang San, we were living in reasonable conditions under a bivouac. You know, it was sort of tented accommodation, but most of us were under bivouacs, and we were getting, you know, roughly about one hot meal a day. When we moved into brigade reserve, ready to counterattack for the King's Own Scottish Borderers, for the time being we were temporarily attached to 28th Brigade, and we were sort of in a wooded area in a valley at the bottom of 217. And the conditions there were dreadful. It was cold, it was misty, it was drizzling. It was one of those occasions when you really felt, you know, you long for a nice warm fire. However, we were given an hour standby when the two forward companies moved up at half battalion strength to attack. And it was in the early hours of the morning. We were tired, we were hungry, we were cold, we were wet, and we were miserable. But that was nothing compared to what we did encounter once we actually got into position, living in holes in the ground. And then, of course, there was one day in early December when the snows came and the Korean winter really came upon us. It wasn't so much the snow or the frost, but it was the bitterly cold wind. The Koreans had a name for it, and for the life of me, I can't remember what it was. But this confounded wind used to blow down from the Siberian Peninsula. And it really, really made life sometimes absolutely intolerable. It's sometimes the chill factor would drop down to perhaps as low as minus 10 or even 15 Fahrenheit. That's minus 15 to 10 Fahrenheit. And there was just nowhere where you could get warm. You couldn't shave, you couldn't clean your teeth, there were no baths, no showers. You woke up in the morning, if you managed to get to sleep, with frost around your mouth and around the top of your sleeping bag. And life was very, very uncomfortable. And during January, when we were in divisional reserve position, it was so cold that the antifreeze in the vehicles was actually becoming slushy. And the antifreeze had been put in the vehicle radiators on a one-to-one basis.